This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of May 5th, 2019. Welcome. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support the Breaker. On this edition, the Is It Just Me commentary. Headlines from the Pacific Rim and Pacific Northwest. The Big Deal feature. Australian professor Clive Hamilton reflects on the Chinese Communist Party's influence campaign after returning home from Canada. Hamilton is the author of Silent Invasion, China's Influence in Australia. And I will award a virtual Nanaimo bar to someone who made a difference. Now, is it just me? Is it just me, or does the Vancouver Whitecaps organization operate in a one-step-up, two-steps-backward basis? In its ninth Major League Soccer season, fans have seen little success on the pitch. They are finally starting to vote with their feet. The April 27th attendance was nowhere near the 17,000-plus that the club announced. When the Breaker gets the real number via Freedom of Information, we'll let you know. Loyal fans and supporters groups, led by the Southsiders, stage another walkout for the last 10 minutes of the first half to protest the club's 2013 hiring of a youth coach at the center of a racist incident in the UK, and to protest the treatment of women who complained about harassment and bullying by their coach as far back as the 2007 W League season. Club owners Greg Kerfoot and Jeff Mallett, but not Steve Nash or Steve Lujo, put their names on the bottom of a wordsmithed apology on May 1st. It came 66 days after former player Kira McCormick went public with allegations about coach Bob Berarda on her blog in late February. Mallett spoke with handpicked media outlets, including rights holder CTV and sponsor Global, but Post Media, News 1130, and the Breaker.News were not invited. The Toronto Star's local edition is a tenant in the same building as the Whitecaps in Gastown, but its reporters were told to take a hike by Whitecaps officials. Is that not one of the most absurd things to happen in Vancouver's sports business history? McCormick said the apology lacked sincerity and accountability. Meanwhile, President Bob Leonarduzzi's silence is deafening. McCormick accused Leonarduzzi of breaking her confidence after she came to him in May 2007 about Berarda's behavior. Leonarduzzi then allegedly turned around and told Berarda the next day that he met with McCormick. She eventually moved to another team. All of this is happening while the Whitecaps are off to a dismal start to the 2019 season. What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines from around the Pacific Rim. In the South China Morning Post, Lori Chen reports, "Hard work got me into Stanford University," says Chinese student in viral video after parents paid $6.5 million to get her accepted. A video shot in 2017 of Zhao Yuxi, the Chinese student whose family paid $6.5 million for her fraudulent admission to Stanford University, has gone viral on social media. In it, she claims she was accepted because of her hard work. In the 90-minute video made when she was 17, Zhao offered viewers advice on getting into prestigious American universities while admitting that her, quote, "natural IQ isn't particularly high," end quote. The alleged payment by Zhao's family was by far the largest in the case, but neither Zhao nor her family have been charged. In the Japan Times, Kyoto reports, Tokyo police investigating drone flights near imperial residences a day after emperor's accession. Police are looking into a number of witness reports of drones being flown May 1st near the imperial palace and other locations in Tokyo linked to the imperial family. The Metropolitan Police Department began receiving reports from riot police in central Tokyo after 8 p.m. of drones flying near the Imperial Palace and the Akasaka Estate, currently home to a few members of the imperial family, including Emperor Naruhito, who stepped up to the throne on April 30th. A drone was also witnessed flying near the imperial graveyard in Hachioji, western Tokyo, where imperial family members, including the great-grandfather and grandfather of Emperor Naruhito, are buried. In Panier News, Duterte war threat versus Canada, just a figure of speech. President Rodrigo's threat of war against Canada over heaps of trash illegally shipped to the Philippines was just an expression of outrage, according to the Malacañang Palace. Presidential spokesman Salvador Pinelo clarified that the president does not intend to engage Ottawa in war, but serious in his warning to return the garbage shipment. He added that Duterte's statement was just a figure of speech. Duterte was referring to 103 containers of Canadian waste, consisting of household trash, plastic bottles and bags, newspapers, and even used adult diapers, that arrived in Manila in batches from 2013 to 2014. Trash from at least 26 containers has been buried in a Tarlac landfill. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines from around the Pacific Northwest. In the Oregonian, Elliot Njus reports, proposed Portland baseball stadium site faces deadline. Pay up or move on. The clock is ticking for the Portland Diamond Project to start paying real money to reserve a marine cargo terminal for its billion-dollar baseball park, or give up on building at the site. By the end of the month, the pro baseball boosters could have to start paying the Port of Portland hundreds of thousands of dollars each year for the exclusive negotiating rights to the Northwest Portland Terminal, where they hope to build a 32,000-seat stadium. The bill for the first 3 months will come to $375,000. We're forging ahead, spokesman John McIsaac said Thursday. Business as usual. In the Victoria News, Nicole Crescenzi reports, Victoria man ready to sell 600 bottles of collector beer. Dave Preston has long been a beer enthusiast. He used to homebrew, write beer reviews in newspapers and magazines, and even became a certified beer judge. He began collecting bottles in the 1980s when he noticed stubby bottles being phased out for long neck bottles, and as a beer judge also received many bottles. From friends' travels and his own, his collection grew to include international editions. Canada, China, the Czech Republic, Denmark, England, Fiji, France, Germany, India, Ireland, Israel, Italy, Jamaica, Japan, Mexico, Russia, Scotland, Turkey, and the USA are just some of the countries represented in his collection. And last week in the Breaker.News, these headlines. Defeated BC Liberal joins company part owned by donor charged in U.S. college admissions scandal. BC Sport Minister calls Whitecaps coaching scandals extremely disturbing. And former SNC-Lavalin executive has a duty to come clean on political donations, says NDP MP. Read the stories behind the headlines in the Breaker.News. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. The case of Meng Wanzhou will be back in court in Vancouver on May 8th, as the authorities get closer to her extradition hearing. The United States government wants to try the Huawei chief financial officer on charges of fraud. She was arrested in Vancouver International Airport last December and is suing the Canadian government, alleging that her constitutional rights were violated when she was arrested. Clive Hamilton is a professor at Charles Sturt University in Canberra, Australia. Hamilton recently returned home after a trip to Canada. He is the author of Silent Invasion, China's Influence in Australia, about how the Chinese Communist Party is gaining influence and interfering in politics down under. He sees the same trend happening in Canada. It is a book that Hamilton had trouble getting published. I spoke to him on Skype.
My original publisher, which had published several of my previous books, was very enthusiastic about this one. But at the last moment, as the book was about to go to the printer, they pulled out and they told me that they were afraid of retaliation from Beijing. They were particularly worried about defamation proceedings that might be launched against the publisher by people acting at the behest of Beijing, causing a massive, resource snarl up at the company, and even if they won, there are very large legal bills to be paid. So they were worried about the commercial implications of publishing a book critical of the Chinese Communist Party. And for a couple of months, I just couldn't find a publisher in Australia. They all ran a mile from it, even though it was very apparent the book would be a commercial success. Eventually, I found a brave and very good publisher that wanted to stand up for free speech. That was Hardy Grant Books in Melbourne. And so they published the book, and indeed it sold like hotcakes. There was obviously a yearning in the Australian public to understand what was going on. And my book explained the overall program of gaining influence in Australia, targeted at our elites by the Chinese Communist Party.
Now, the Chinese Communist Party, we're seeing it here in Canada now, but you saw it for many years before in Australia, that it has gained quite a bit of influence through expat communities, through business groups, through academic groups, by using its culture really to try to gain influence and in some cases interfere in politics. What were some of the tipping points that you saw that were the most egregious?
Well, it's a really a systematic campaign, a program, perhaps one should say, by the Chinese Communist Party to undermine resistance to it. That is, to its ambitions, to the expansion of China, its economic ambitions and its political and strategic ambitions, to undermine resistance to that within countries like Canada, Australia, the United States, and plenty of others, of course. And so it's not just a process of the infusion of Chinese culture, which really is Chinese Communist Party culture. It's a much more systematic program, usually captured under the term United Front activities, emanating primarily, but not solely, from a very big and active department of the Chinese Communist Party called the United Front Work Department. And so what we see is a proliferation in Canada and Australia within the Chinese diaspora of organizations that are essentially front organizations for the parties. And these organizations have two roles. One is to win over Chinese Canadians, in your case, so that they will be supporters of the activities and ambitions of the Chinese Communist Party by drawing on their patriotism or using financial incentives. Or if they're inclined to be critical of the party, then undertaking various measures to silence them. And there have been some pretty brutal methods of silencing Chinese Canadians and Chinese Australians who don't toe the party line. The second major focus of their activity is on elites, elites in Canadian politics, in universities, in business, of course, in cultural activities, in the media. Everywhere where there's a center of power or influence, there will be some attempt, often very successful, by the Chinese Communist Party to gain influence. Probably in Canada, we see it most obviously in the, in the political domain, but it's very obvious in the business domain. But in politics, I think we've seen it very much in the recent and extremely difficult imbroglio around the arrest of Meng Wanzhou. And it really has split open the influence process, because it's caused a number of people, journalists, academics, activists, to look much more closely and expose the activities of the Chinese Communist Party. And, of course, Jonathan Manthorpe's recent book, Claws of the Panda, is an extremely valuable expose, tracking the way in which the Communist Party since the 1970s has exerted influence within the political system in Canada, particularly the Liberal Party, and the kind of ultimate demonstration of that is the way in which the Trudeau government, and Justin Trudeau in particular, have, in the face of this extraordinary bullying campaign from Beijing, behaved like, you know, deer caught in the headlights. Suddenly, this great power, which they thought was their friend and which they thought could, they could influence, turns into not the panda, but the dragon, which is extremely aggressive and undertaking and violating every rule and convention. And the Trudeau government does not know what to do because it's so contrary to the worldview, their view of China, which has been deeply inculcated into the thinking of senior liberals over many years.
Now, this is an interesting phenomenon because China, of course, is a country that does not have the rule of law. It's a country that does not have a free press. It doesn't have the human rights that we enjoy in Western countries, but the United Front program in Western countries relies on being able to use the freedoms that we enjoy to spread those messages in order to gain influence over political forces, business forces, as well as the diaspora.
Yes, it's very, very cynical, but that's the nature of the Chinese Communist Party. As Xi Jinping has been cracking down over the last several years, even more deeply on any expression of human rights, the arrest of human rights lawyers, of course, the vast concentration camps in Xinjiang, and a whole range of activities which is creating a totalitarian society. At the same time, the agents of influence of the CCP in places like Canada are exploiting the democratic practices of countries like Canada. And so, for example, you have CCP agents of influence using the legal process to go after their critics and to silence their critics. And complaining, you know, these Communist Party agents of influence complaining about their rights are being violated and so on. We see CCP agents of influence, both ones in the Chinese diaspora and ones in the mainstream community, using the free press to push what is essentially a Communist Party line. We see, particularly in recent years, Chinese Communist Party linked organizations actively promoting trustworthy individuals from the diaspora to enter into politics at the local government level, at provincial government, and at federal government level. In other words, to place their people in decision-making positions. And so we now see, in fact, you know, the CCP has a specific program around promoting trustworthy ethnic Chinese people to enter into politics, grooming young people, training them, supporting them going into politics, infiltrating the main political parties and so on. It's called Huaren Kanjiang. And so we now see these people starting to appear in Canadian parliaments, as indeed we are in Australian parliaments. And it's deeply concerning that people whose allegiance is to a foreign country and a totalitarian foreign political party now being represented at local, provincial and federal level. It's something that we in democratic countries really have to grapple with. And so I think this is kind of the next big thing. Very, very difficult, but we have to do it.
Do you think that with the heightened attention here in Canada that has reached a tipping point with the Meng Wanzhou arrest late last year, that the United Front may change the way it functions and be more subtle? Or do you think it'll be more aggressive, especially this year is an interesting and important year here in Canada as well as in China? Here in Canada, we do have a federal election coming up in October. This is also a year of many anniversaries that, you know, in Chinese history, coming up, of course, the 30th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre, which China has never come to terms with and keeps the information, the truth about it away from its own people. And then later this year, there are other anniversaries that the Chinese government will be promoting to its people, such as, you know, the founding of the Republic, the People's Republic. Do you think that we're entering a new phase in how the United Front works, how the Communist Party influences foreign populations?
It's a good question. In Australia, over the last 2 years, we've had a fairly sustained and substantial pushback by the federal government against CCP influence in Australian institutions. And there have been a whole range of measures. Perhaps the centrepiece has been the new foreign interference law, which effectively criminalises a broad range of activities, which are United Front activities. Not all of them, because some of them are a bit too subtle and difficult to get at, but many of the activities that I describe in my book are now criminal offences. And so I think what we've seen is a shift, and it's very hard to know, you know, unless you, you know, manage to hack into the Chinese embassy, which I imagine is quite hard to do, you're not going to get documentary evidence of it. And my impression is that the United Front activity has shifted increasingly to the periphery, if you like, more of the outlying states in Australia, as a way of a heavier influence on state governments, the equivalent of your provincial governments, and also at local government level, because federal politicians are now much more wary of who they're associating with and what their United Front links might be. In Canada, a lot depends, I think, on what the Trudeau government does in the next couple of months. If the Trudeau government allows Canada to be bullied by, for example, not extraditing Meng Wanzhou or failing to ban Huawei from the 5G network or collaborating one way or another with Chinese authorities in suppressing protests about the Tiananmen Square massacre, which some pro-democracy Chinese Canadians will undoubtedly engage in on the 4th of June. If the Canadian government, you know, backs off, gives way to pressure, then Canada really is in big trouble, because the CCP knows that its program of influence buying and influence gathering over the last decades has been extremely effective, so effective it can get away with outrageous bullying and not get any pushback. Now, of course, the whether or not the government will push back depends essentially on the Canadian people, whether they demand it. So I think how the CCP and United Front operations evolve in Canada over the next months and years will depend a lot on what happens in the next 2-3 months with how the Canadian government and indeed the Canadian people respond to the current situation.
That was Clive Hamilton, professor at Charles Sturt University in Canberra, Australia, via Skype. He is the author of Silent Invasion, China's Influence in Australia. The Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting. Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a Virtual Nanaimo Bar to a deserving person or organization that has made a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes posthumously this week to Jason Botchford and to his family and friends who are grieving the sports writer and broadcaster's death. The Vancouver Canucks beat reporter died at age 48 last week of apparent heart failure. One of his former colleagues at the Toronto Sun, Joe Warmington, had this to say about Botchford, his former co-worker. Botchford was the epitome of a journalistic rock star. He had a flair for language, a passion for whatever he covered. He was a kind soul. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send us an email to Bob at thebreaker.news. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of May 5th, 2019. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on May 5th in 1904, Cy Young of the Boston Americans pitched the first perfect game in baseball's modern era against the Philadelphia Athletics? Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.